Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Chet Haas from the Android Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
I'm Romain Guy from the team that still doesn't have a name.
One of these days, man.
One of these days.
And today we have...
Dave Burke, VP of Engineering for Android.
VP of Engineering. We've never had that title on the show before.
Yeah. It's way above your pay grade, Chet.
Okay, so the first question that begs is, what does a VP of engineering do? Like, you've got a really large team doing lots of stuff. So what does that translate
to? And for the listeners, this is not one of our questions we know the answer to. We really want to know, what do you do?
Wait. Do I ever know the answer to the questions? All right.
I think my primary job is tech support for other execs at Google. I'm kind of joking, but not really. It's a good question. I think the job changes. It depends on what is needed at any given time. The way I think about it is, when I come into work in the morning, it's what are the one, two, or three things that only I can do in this role? And then the second question is, am I doing those?
You want to do those?
Do you want to do those? Yeah. And it's like, it's a cool job because it mixes up a lot of different things, from week to week, month to month, quarter to quarter. It might be focus on an architectural issue, or it might be focus on a sort of product area. It might be, figuring out scaling different parts of the organization to make sure we're investing in different areas. It might be looking at different areas for innovation and are we capitalizing on those? So it's really a mix of things. For me personally, I think, left to my own devices, I would probably be an individual contributor academic. Left alone, just like getting deep into a problem.
You would write white papers?
I'm not really sure. Here's the thought process. So I'd start with that. That would seem like the most enjoyable, peaceful life. But then I want to make a big impact. So I I'll do something in industry where I can contribute a software that goes to billions of people. So you do that. And then once you're in that position, you're like, well, I'm just one engineer. I can only do so much. So I think I'll manage a team because then I could get the team to do more. And then I think the challenge, honestly, is when you're leading a big team is how do you stay technical and relevant? How do you make sure your skills don't erode? And so I think you actually have to work really hard at constantly, this phrase lifelong learning, constantly trying to learn new things.
Actually,
and pushing yourself.
Could you teach Chet how to do that?
Actually, that's a general management thing that I think all of the technical managers hit. It's how do you effectively lead a team when you are not necessarily checking in the code and don't have your mind around all the bits happening in the team?
Right? Yeah, and what's particularly bad is it takes a few years for your skills to deteriorate. Right. So at first it feels like you're on top of it.
Yes.
If you're not careful, then little by little.
Yes. I think the most important thing for anyone going into engineering management is to first have actually been an engineer for a long time. I think you just learn a lot of stuff and you hone your instincts. And then, later when you're a manager, you'll see patterns and you'll have a good instinct for things. And then it's just constantly pushing yourself. 2 months ago, I was I don't know a lot about cryptocurrencies. And I was I'll go dig into these. So I started reading the Bitcoin code and the Bitcoin white paper, and you kind of go down a rabbit hole. But it's important to do that because then you're constantly learning and you've got to push yourself to keep doing that. And I actually like doing that, so it's okay.
How much of that do you do, and how much of it, are you studying sort of what goes on in your org versus sort of other things in industry?
You come to work every day, so you're going to be pulled into the stuff that's around you, right? So that's going to happen anyway. I try to understand things at a deep level in the sense that I'll constantly be reading bugs and code reviews flying by. I'm not actually on the hook to do any code reviews, but just, it's really helpful to see what people are working on and what.
Well, I remember, I think it was a couple of months back, you posted the source code for some robot project, and it was it's a studio project you can check out. I was very, very excited, but it had the build that Gradle file.
Yeah.
Chet would be proud.
Yeah. I do that at home, in projects with the kids. I was just building a little AI robot using TensorFlow. And the idea was that the phone is the brain of the robot, and then it talks Bluetooth to another circuit that I made that then controls the robot, has motor controllers and whatnot, and then uses TensorFlow as its object recognition. But, I was doing that because I was I want to play around with TensorFlow a little bit, but I also wanted to just check up on uTor and make sure that Studio is working well. And I can report back that it was great. It was great. Well, actually, the integration with Studio on GitHub was awesome. I had never done that. I never, back when we started Android Hell, we had Subversion, not even Git on the operating system. So the world's moved along. And so it was just fun to try that out. And I actually think that's important. you know, one of the advice I would give to any sort of engineering leader, even a product leader, is like, use your products. Like, it's like such an obvious thing, but like really use them. And so this was just a great excuse for me to play around with Studio's latest features.
You were still checking, at least a couple of years ago, you were checking in like, you know, graphics bug fixes and stuff. I assume that's still not happening, but it is one of the defining characteristics to me of like the management chain that I've observed since I've been on Android, is that everybody up the chain, A, was an engineer for a long time, B, is still interested in being an engineer, yeah. And so still highly technical. I doubt with the size of your group that you can still do that, but I think that the fact that you could actually dive into some specific domain and make a change, you know, I think it's actually kind of good for the team to see that the leaders, you know, are that closely connected, but it also, I assume, help you more closely connect to those specific elements that you wanted to, you know, push or stay on top of.
Yeah, exactly. I wish I had more time to do more. I mean, the trick, of course, is being an engineering manager, like pick something off the critical path, like either something that you need to do in like 6 months time or a bug that's not totally critical, but no one else is going to get to.
I can give you a few bugs.
Yeah.
I'm thinking graphics, not in the critical path.
Yeah. That's true. You know, that now because my organization is so big, it's hard, much, much harder to do that. And so I'm kind of relegated to writing code at home with hobby projects.
Which isn't so bad because, you know, you don't have to deal with code reviews and process.
These kids are brutal in their code reviews.
Yeah, they are. My 9-year-old and 7-year-old, they're pretty demanding. They're like pretty ambitious. And, you know, you got to be able to convert their ideas into code like pretty fast when they get bored. And so it's high stakes, high pressure stuff.
And the performance reviews there are just
brutal, man. Brutal. Daddy, you're missing expectations.
All right. So that was the progression of your career to what you're doing right now. What did you actually do when you hit Android? Like, where did it start?
Yeah, for me, I mean, I started in 2007, and this was sort of pre-Android and pre-iPhone. And, you know, the idea was, hey, let's go invest more in mobile. And I was running teams that were effectively converting desktop experiences into mobile. And at that time, mobile was a very fragmented place. So it was, you know, Windows Phone and J2ME and all sorts of things like that. And then, you know, there was this sort of Android project off in the corner of Google, and it was pretty small. And you know, we, the mobile team, were getting very frustrated that we'd have all these ideas, but we couldn't implement them because the APIs on these various devices were just not flexible enough, or they were locked down, or the tools were awful, or the behaviors were different from device to device. And so increasingly, we started working more and more on Android. And then at a certain point, you know, I had projects on Android, and at a certain point, it made sense to just sort of get involved directly in the operating system. Yeah. I think one of the first things I was involved in was on the web browser side. And so
yeah, your team was doing Gears, right? The Gears plugin?
Yeah, yeah. Gears plugin for Chrome. And we were doing a bunch of web APIs like geolocation, et cetera. And Android was super exciting because it had a full, what did we say back in 2008? We would say it's a full desktop browser or something. We basically meant it was a WebKit rendering engine, and so it could actually render full, you know, real websites.
Yeah, it wasn't WAP.
WAP or WML and all that stuff. Yeah, or CHTML. And so that was exciting, but, you know, we were working with the Chrome team. I could see that what the Chrome team were doing, so it much further beyond WebKit. You know, their mantra is really fast, secure, and simple. And they put a ton of effort into, you know, the security layers of Chrome and a bunch of other areas and performance. And so, you know, I started getting involved with like, well, hey, how do we bring Chrome to Android? And so that was one of the first projects. And I think it was interesting, you know, back then, like autofill didn't really work. But now autofill is like crucial on mobile, right? Or even simple things like zooming and panning at high performance was tough. But, you know, I was also interested in like, how does a web browser change as it gets to mobile? And actually today, I think some like 90% of apps have a web view embedded in them. So they're actually rendering HTML content with effectively a browser engine. And over time, then we sort of discovered new ideas like Chrome custom tabs. So that, you know, you're in Twitter and you click on a link and there's a web page, and actually it seamlessly shows that web page, but you're still in Twitter, yet the cookie jar shared with your one web browser on the device. And so it was pretty interesting to sort of seed some of that stuff.
And then you were a part of the change from the Android browser, which was the browser at the beginning, into using Chrome eventually, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that was tough from a, you know, from an engineering organization point of view. If you back up a little bit, you know, if you want to create a new operating system, you have a bootstrap problem, which is, hey, I've got this operating system, I need apps. And you go to the app developers and they're like, well, there's no users of your operating system, so why would I focus on this? And so the way you bootstrap a new platform, a new operating system, is your core team has to actually build the first seed set of apps, right? Yeah.
Yeah, like we did on Android.
Exactly.
We built all the apps.
We built all the apps, right? And it's really good because it helps you understand the framework and the API design. Does it work? And you can iterate on that as you're building the apps. The web browser, of course, you know, the same reason really was built by the Android team. But at a certain point, you know, naturally as the platform takes off, you know, the Gmail team at a certain point is like, well, that's really cute, the Gmail app you guys wrote on Android, but like, we should probably take it over now. And that's a natural thing, right? I think the web browser was a little more tricky because it's like, hey, the Chrome team really, like, they've got a, you know, an amazing roadmap. They've got a lot of technology. They've got a built-out team. Really, they should probably be doing the browser. And that's hard because your kind of team has to give up something for
that. We already had ties with Chrome, right? Because we are using bits from Chrome.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, when I say it was hard for a couple of months. And then we're like, yeah, I think everyone realized that it made total sense to go do this. And actually, we did it in pieces. Like, I remember now we had...
Did you take the network stack first?
We took the network stack, that's right. And then we took the JavaScript engine because WebKit's default was JSC, which was an interpreted JavaScript engine. And Chrome had this thing called V8, which compiled to bytecode. And so it was really cool, a just-in-time compiler. And so we started by bringing in these pieces. And then at a certain point, it's like, okay, well, let's just like make the Android browser be a flavor of the Chrome browser. And so the rest is history.
And then from that, I know you like took over some of the graphics and media stuff and sort of built from there.
Yeah, I think I think one of the first things I really got stuck into was graphics performance.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, it keeps going.
I remember spending a few hours in SysTrace thanks to you.
Yeah. Well, so like, do you remember before SysTrace? Like I remember, So SysTrace, for people who don't know, is this very detailed system tracing. Which came from Chrome also. And it's like, think of it as a stack set of time series graphs. One time series might be the frequency of the CPU. Another time series might be the jobs on the CPU. Another one might be a clock or et cetera. And so you can actually like stack things and you can figure out what's happening in the system. But before SysTrace, like, you know, you'd have jank, you know, the frame rate would be jerky and you'd have no idea. You'd have to sort of speculate what was happening.
I mean, I spent, you know, years profiling apps on Android and working on performance, but the only tools we had were per process, per app. So you could see that things seemed too slow in the app, but you didn't really know why. And the only guess you could have was, well, the code is too slow. Okay.
Right.
But with SysTrace, we had this picture of the entire OS and we discovered relationships that we could not imagine before.
Yeah, it was like a new window into the system. Mm-hmm. It was kind of profound. And, you know, we kind of knew this, but it was very clear when you saw the first SysTraces, like we had no real frame pacing. Like we didn't have a hardware vSync to actually clock the frame rates. You know, on a modern smartphone, you want to be 60 frames per second traditionally. And so we weren't clocking that off the hardware. And so that was one of the things we introduced. And then once we had that, we're like, okay, well, where's the bottleneck? Okay. And then the next thing you want to think about is, well, you know, the latencies from touch to actual photons reaching your retina and where are those? And so we kind of went down this great effective rabbit hole. And then we pulled together a bunch of improvements and we put them under the moniker Project Butter. And that was one of the, I think it was Jelly Bean. That was one of the themes of the release. And that stuff kind of paid off because it laid the foundation for, you know, more ambitious UI paradigms that came later, like material design and whatnot. And if we hadn't done that, we wouldn't have been able to.
Well, it also gave us a more systemic approach to fixing performance. Because before, I mean, obviously we were doing performance work, but with every release, you know, you add more code and you lose the performance that you gained the past release.
Yeah.
And because it was all, you know, not necessarily macro optimizations, but very targeted. And when you start doing it at the system level more fundamentally, then you keep those optimizations most of the time.
I think that, so zooming forward to like 2019, oh my God, it's 2019. One of the goals and challenges that we have in front of us now is like we have these like really powerful tools, but for those to be effective for a developer, you actually need to understand quite a lot about the system. Like how does Surface Flinger, the system compositor work, and how does that interact with the display pipeline, and how does the CPU governors affect that? And so one of the things that we are interested in investing in is like, how do we make that tool simpler? Like, is there an overlay on top of that that can help developers understand what's happening and how to optimize their apps without having a PhD in how the system dynamics of Android work?
Yeah, that's a very good point, because even for folks like us who've been doing this for years, I mean, the you know, the system has been growing, and it's really difficult to keep track of all the changes within the system that you need to know to understand those performance issues.
Yeah, exactly.
And things change quickly.
Another area on media that I worked on early on, it's kind of interesting to think about it now, but when I started, I guess that was 2010, I want to say, the way that the media framework worked, if you wanted to play a video, even if you want to play audio, you would have to hand the framework a HTTP link. It was very high level. And then over time, people, I think even the early version of Google Play Music had a little HTTP server in the app.
Yeah, didn't people were writing like content providers in their applications?
Yeah. Well, then even before the content provider would be slightly more elegant, people were actually writing little web servers with loopback, like, you know, 127.001, like, and you would connect back to yourself and then you would try to stream these things. But worse than that was that, you know, for advanced media applications, they needed more capability. And so you had some middleware that started appearing from different companies that would give you lower level access to the media framework, but they weren't built on any public API. They were kind of using hidden APIs and reaching into the system. And then what would happen is every time we come up with a new version of Android, all those APIs, of course, would change because they're not APIs. And the middleware would break, and then the middleware would break all the applications that depended on it. And it was just painful for everybody involved. And so one of the things I focused on early was low-level APIs. So the framework should have, you know, a media codec, which it has today, or a media extractor for opening media files, or media DRM, et cetera. And so we created all of those. And then, in addition, we created libraries, which are available open source. One in particular is ExoPlayer.
Yep.
Which is built on these low-level APIs, which and because it's open source and because it's a library, we can update it frequently. And it supports higher-level things like MPEG Dash, which is a streaming format, and HLS, HTTP Live Streaming, et cetera. And now fast forward to today, and you know, pretty much every major media distribution service from Netflix to BBC to CNN uses ExoPlayer on top of these low-level APIs. Every time we rev the version of Android, they don't break because those low-level APIs are public contracts and firm. And so that's, you know, one of those nice things it's been nice for me to sort of see play out. And actually, it's a pattern that I think makes a lot of sense, which is for the framework, make sure you have the lowest level primitives there, and as much stuff as you can put into a library, do that. And that's really the philosophy of Jetpack.
Which is,
yeah, we've been talking about this a lot.
Exactly. Right. So exactly what most of my team has been migrating toward is that world of, okay, well, all the fundamentals are there in the platform. We no longer need to necessarily add those APIs to the platform. Instead, why don't we do it in the static libraries that you can build and ship with your app and depend on release to release?
Yeah. And I think that's good, because I think things, you know, technology changes, like on the media side, streaming formats and streaming technologies and streaming protocols change. So you want that flexibility to be able to update. And it's the same thing with apps. You know, different paradigms come up and
All right. So that's how you got here and what you do. Then one of the questions we were talking about, what do you ask a VP of engineering, what exactly they work on? How do we choose what to work on, right? So you're obviously involved in, like, what are the major themes that are released? What are the things that the platform is lacking? What do we want to enable for, you know, Pixel phones in the next releases or whatever? Like, how do you derive those?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I was thinking a little bit about it. If you think about traditional operating systems, they were built, you know, by teams that would sort of disappear for 3, 4, 5 years.
Yeah.
And they'd go off and they'd work on this big elaborate release, and they would sort of emerge several years later hoping that the world was either the way they left it when they went off to work on this, or at least the predicted version of what they were expecting the world to be. And that's really hard to do because technology moves so, so fast. I think, you know, with more newer operating systems, you know, Android's 10 years old, we work on an annual cadence. We move much more quickly. And in fact, you know, really we're kind of doing 7 months of development sort of internally, and then 5 months of sort of developer previews and beta out in the open. And so it allows us to move much more quickly, which I think is good. You know, when we're thinking about what we put into the release, I think there's multiple components. I think, first of all, there's a bottoms-up component, which is, you know, if you want to know what to improve in your audio framework or in your location stack or in your kernel, you should probably go to the teams that are experts in that first. Because they know, right? Like every team within the OS, you know, really, if you think about it, they have a long list of features that they want to do. And it's multiple years of work. And so each year for them, it's reprioritizing and sort of chewing off the top issues that they think are most important at the time. And so I think that's a really important component of planning a release. Now, that said, you also need a tops-down sort of element to it, because you need to be out there talking to your developers, to, you know, working on user studies, talking to device makers, and actually understanding what they need, understanding what the technology trends are, and then sort of making some calculated guesses on where you're going. And so that's sort of how we do release planning, both directions, bottoms up and tops down. And it's been pretty effective for us. And I think the other thing I try to push on with every release, and you'll see it with each one, which is, I think it's really important to have like a set of foundational sort of long-term investments that you're making in a release, as well as sort of immediate nice features that are available to users or developers. And so you want a mix of those two things. You don't want to be always just like short-term feature, and you also don't want to be always sort of long-term foundation. There has to be a mix.
Well, I guess a good example of a long-term foundation would be something like Treble, right?
Right, exactly, yeah. And so that's like something that will benefit us over a set of multiple years. But like having released just with Project Treble is probably not going to be super exciting.
I'm sure our users would love to read the release notes. Yeah, yeah. It's like, there's a hell. What?
Yeah. Look at this hell. That's sort of like the nature of it. And then, you know, I mean, there's just so many technology trends that we sort of embrace. I think one of the obvious ones is sort of AI, right? And you know, the emergence of deep learning and more, you know, effective uses of it. And so how do you build that into the system? Or, you know, you see things like big trend on edge-to-edge displays.
Foldables.
Foldables, exactly. Yeah. You know, just when you thought you saw everything in phones. And, you know, foldables is a great one, which is, you know, we were very aware of the supply chain technology that was coming and that you could do some really cool stuff. And so we wanted to make sure that in the upcoming version of Android that we can support different type of foldable use cases that come out.
So I guess we must be approached by manufacturers. We're not just, you know, reading magazines going, oh, someone's going to have foldables, right? So we have partners that work with us saying, hey, we've got an interesting thing here. Wouldn't it be nice if users could take advantage of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things I love about Android is we work very closely with our ecosystem. So one of the things we actually do is every 6 months we go to Asia, typically Hong Kong, and we will meet with every single major device maker and silicon vendor. And we'll spend, you know, several days working very intensely with them, you know, learning about what their plans are, what their challenges are, communicating what we're planning to do, and we use that input to direct, you know, where we're going next. That's on the device maker side. On the developer side, we do, you know, consumer advisory boards. We bring people in, and, you know, again, we ask for stack rankings, what features they would like, et cetera. And then, of course, we do lots of user studies. So it's really, you get all that data in. And
it's their advantage, too, right? Because if we were to add operating system support for some hardware they want to sell, we're going to sell more if it's in Android.
Exactly.
What I find interesting about the user studies or you know, or with developers that we do this constantly. It's not like once a year.
Right.
So we do this all year long.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we get that input coming all the time.
Is the annual cadence right, you think?
I think it's a good question. I think...
Three times a year.
Yeah. It's true. So we have the big release at dessert, then we have we sort of have these quarterly updates, and then we actually have monthly updates where we issue security bulletins and critical fixes to the industry. So there's actually a lot of releases in the year that people don't realize. The other thing that people don't realize is that like, a lot of Android is already componentized and updating on a much faster schedule. So if you look at what you're actually using on your phone, many of the built-in apps, for example, some of those are updating on a weekly cadence, right? If you look at something like Google Play Services, which contains a lot of foundational pieces, such as the location stack, it has like authentication, it's got SSL, all of those libraries are updating on a sort of 6 to 8 week schedule.
Or the web view.
And the web view as well.
Keyboard, right?
Yeah, keyboard. Like, and so if you actually look at other mobile operating systems and you look at their kind of release notes, you'll see that like half their release notes are updates to the built-in applications. And that doesn't happen on Android. All of those are updating all the time. And so there's a lot of, you know, we have this very fluid thing. And I think it's not, you know, it's not well understood that is the case, but I think it's important and allows us to move really quickly.
Including the static library thing we were talking about before.
Yeah,
so if
exactly.
Xcode Player decides to release a new feature, they can do that now and apps can start
exactly.
building and shipping with it immediately.
Precisely.
Or support library or whatever.
Yeah.
I just completely ran out of ideas. Oh, you mentioned Treble.
Yes.
Where is Treble at? This is maybe an example of something where, okay, so you get manufacturers telling you, you know, where hardware is going and we need to integrate that into the platform. You get developers coming to us and asking for features or telling us about pain points, but we also need to anticipate things that they're not bringing up, right?
Right.
We need to see, you know, what is something that we could enable that we believe users, developers, manufacturers would appreciate and be able
right.
to use.
Yes.
Right? You can't just be reactive.
Right, totally.
So then what's the magic process for that?
You know, I think
have smart people on the team.
Yeah, have smart people, have innovative people, have you know, prototyping projects, have design sprints, anticipate where the market's going. And I mean, I think definitely the biggest things are anticipating. Like, I think if you look at the Google Pixel, for example, the phone that Google's hardware team produces, you know, one of the biggest features that people love about it is the camera, right? And one of the hottest features of the camera in the latest release was night sight, this ability to take amazing photos at night. They're just kind of mind-blowing.
It's great.
Yeah, but it wasn't like, you know, hey, in June, you know what would be great? It's actually many years ago, we were like, well, how do we improve the quality of photography, you know, given these sort of limited optics? And we realized quickly that, well, you know, we can't really improve the spatial aspects, but we can improve the temporal aspects. So why don't we have burst mode photography? And then we went on this sort of adventure of creating all of the camera framework that's to support burst mode photography. Burst mode photography, the idea is that you have a chain of requests that you send down to the system going, please take a shot with this exposure and this white balance, then take another shot with a slightly different exposure, and then take this other shot with a slightly different zoom, and then take this other shot. And it sort of pipelines all those photos back to you, and then you post-process them. And so we kind of anticipated that you could do a lot with that. And so we built that out. And it's proven to be really valuable, right? Like, so for starters, when you take a photo on a Pixel, we have this thing called HDR Plus. And so when you take a single photo, actually underneath the hood, it's taking up to about 12 photos and post-processing them. If you zoom in, we're actually taking multiple photos as you zoom in, and we're actually jittering the lens. So again, that sort of pipeline, we're asking it to take a photo with the lens moved slightly to the left, and then take another photo with the lens jittered, and then post-processing all of those. With night sight, we're extending that and taking even more shots, and then playing around with white balance and whatnot. And so that was one of those things where we sort of anticipated, like, let's create the conditions, and then we'll be able to innovate on top of that. And so I think there's a lot to be said for trying to figure out, like, areas that have high potential, and then setting up the conditions for those, and then innovating over time.
I think there's still further we could go. It seems like we could integrate the technology that we have, like the photography stuff, as well as some of the search capabilities, so that when I take a picture, it'll automatically go out to the web and grab one of Romain's pictures and substitute mine with his.
Yeah, and then put your name on it.
That'll be
perfect.
There are some rights issues. As long as we don't tell him about it, it's probably fine.
I think that's probably fine.
Okay. Good. So just a feature suggestion. All right, so back to Treble.
Yes.
So that was, I know I'm asking you in particular about this because I know you were one of the people pushing hard for this and talking about it at I.O. So where is it at?
Yeah, it's a great question. So,
what is it?
Yeah. What is it? Well, so first of all, where does the name come from? It's called Project Treble because it's all about the bass. and the bass is the base of the operating system. And so if you look at very early versions of Android, you know, like Android 1 or Android 1.1, there is a thing called a HAL, a hardware abstraction layer. And the idea is it's an interface that separates the sort of silicon and device-specific aspects of the phone from the rest of the framework. And so something could be like, I'm trying to think early days, it would be like GPS, right? There would be a GPS.h interface that would abstract the GPS chip, for example. But the thing about these interfaces, they were kind of loosely, you know, kind of keep your code organized as opposed to being truly binary compatible as you change versions of Android. And the goal of Project Treble was to reduce the costs of updating a device. You know, one of the things that we spent a lot of time on is like trying to increase the velocity of the device OEM device ecosystem. So when there's a new version of Android, we would really like the device ecosystem to catch up and have the latest version of Android. And, you know, from talking at these summits and partner meetings that we do, we realize that, well, actually, it's really expensive to update a new version of Android. And why is that? Well, you make a change somewhere and it has a ripple effect and it takes its time to rework it. So the idea of Project Treble is have very formal interfaces at the bottom of
and
Android.
And more specifically, if we make a change that, let's say, breaks, you know, some assumption at the API level for the hardware for a device manufacturer, they can't necessarily fix it themselves. They would have to go to another vendor that provides the GPS.
Exactly.
And so that's a problem. Like, and if we do that in multiple places, suddenly they have, like, the chain of dependency becomes huge.
Right. And so the vision with Treble, and it's not even the vision, this is how it works today, you can take the new version of Android and take your existing hardware device, and it'll actually just work. Because your what we call your vendor implementation, all of the low-level implementation of your GPS chip and your display and the vibrate module and whatnot, all that code still works because the interface is fixed and binary compatible between those versions. There was an email, it was just actually in December, and I was reading it, and somebody wrote on it, one of our internal engineers, and they were experimenting with something in Qt, Qt's the new version of Android that we're working on, top secret. who would have guessed Q comes after P? And I have no idea what we're going to call it, by the way, but I digress. And so in this email, the person was saying they wanted to experiment with a new feature in Q, and they were saying, well, so I took this device, and it was a third-party OEM. I took the device, and then I compiled a Q system image, and then I ran the Q system image on it, and then I made this experiment. And I was just reading the email going, wait, that's crazy. The fact that you could take this phone that you bought in a store and actually take the new version of Android, run it on top of it, and then start developing it. And that's like a profound change for us, and certainly for our partners too. And you're starting to see the effects of that. So at Google I.O. In the last summer, we had 6 devices on the beta available, and that was directly attributed to the minimal effort required.
Interesting. I saw that in the keynote. I didn't realize that was like a Treble enablement thing.
Totally, yeah. Totally. Okay. Yes. Right. And then the other thing that Treble's enabled us to do is work much more closely with the silicon vendors. So the silicon vendors are, you know, when we say silicon vendors, we really mean the SoC, the system on chip, the big main core piece of silicon that device makers take. And it's allowed us to work directly with them because the abstractions now between their code and our code are so much more clear. And so that means if you're a device maker, you can now get, you know, the latest Qualcomm chip with the latest Android dessert in development and just pull the code and it'll just run. And so it parallelizes what was previously a serial thing where you would have to wait for Google to do its thing, and then you would wait for the chip vendor to do their thing, and then you would, as a device maker, take the code. But now it can happen in parallel.
So is this a required part of Android now? So if you buy, you know, a phone that comes with Android Pie, it will have Treble, and you will be guaranteed then that this hardware you could continue using with new versions of Android?
So it was required for all new devices from O forward. And so Pie was the first time that you started seeing the benefit of it. But really the pain, because it was a lot of work for us internally, all went into O, into Oreo.
So I can see also potentially another advantage is that it levels the playing field. Because if you need those changes from your vendors, like you're making a device, and if you're, I don't know, a small vendor or you don't have the same relationship as another one with your supplier for the SoC, you would have to maybe wait longer. Whereas now, like, everybody's on the same page, like there's no advantage.
Exactly.
And
then the other thing is that, you know, the mobile industry is just so competitive, and you know, the margins are, like many industries, are getting squashed and squashed. And so this reduces your engineering costs, which is good for customers because it helps enable lower and lower cost devices. So it's just generally a good thing. But again, it's one of those long-term things. Like, you know, we're also starting to see new use cases that are possible through Treble that we hadn't seen before, which I probably shouldn't talk about. But but you know, it's just one of the, it sort of opens up the door to new ideas. And again, you know, in generally in software, like abstractions with binary compatibility are generally a good thing, right? It's, you know, from a hygiene perspective.
I'm also thinking about it in terms of the development of Android, you know, the platform, the thing that we ship year after year. So in a unrelated conversation with Ilyan, who was behind a lot of the Treble stuff, and was talking about it on the podcast a few months ago, he was saying in the early days, Android basically wrote all of its own drivers from a combination of, you know, well, we can, you know, certainly do this better because we know what we're doing, but also because, you know, well, it was kind of a startup within Google. You couldn't really get the attention of people. You kind of needed to do all your own stuff.
Exactly.
So there was this state where, you know, well, we're writing the kernel and we're writing the drivers and everything's probably plugging in really messy ways. And then eventually we evolved to a system where it's like, no, actually that chip vendor probably knows how to write their driver better than we do and more maintainable. And then this is the next evolution of that, where we more cleanly define the interfaces so that they can update more quickly. Cool. Okay, so softball question. Favorite Android feature in P?
There's so many. Usually I like to
I knew you would say that.
I usually like to try to pick something like super weird and esoteric, but I think I'll pick something obvious. And I think it's the set of smart features that we added, right? So things like auto awesome batteries, smart screen brightness, the night side feature I mentioned, app prediction. And it's the reason why they're my favorite set of features is not so much about like immediately the value of them, which undoubtedly there's great value from them. It's kind of the mindset that we've switched to, which is applying machine learning to everyday uses and how the operating system works. I'm just excited by all of the potential. There's so many great ideas that we have and that we're actually working on of applying machine learning to various parts of the operating system. And it's everything from like, you know, how the UI works to making it more predictive, true to like really like gnarly internal, you know, machinations of how the system works. And so it's kind of like a mindset shift, I would say.
Possible slogan could be making your phone think so you don't have to. I'll just toss that out there for
And the
free.
Next step will be to replace the engineers with machine learning. And
then,
and then the customers will be machine learning by machine learning for machine learning.
It's all part of the plan. We weren't going to talk about future developments here. But
Actually, the other thing that I do like in Pi, which maybe in certain circles hasn't had enough attention, is the app bundle work. So we actually changed how you can distribute apps, that you can actually break your apps into pieces and you can dynamically load them on demand when the user wants the feature. And that was a really profound change for us, because we had to change the operating system. We had to change all of the cloud play infrastructure end to end. And it's a really valuable thing for app developers. It saves a lot of space. It's good for users. And it's just one of those gnarly kind of year-long projects that just that sort of set us up for the next, you know, N years.
In a really nice way, too, because it's easy for developers to adopt that thing.
Like, exactly.
This is not, you know, restructure your entire application to take advantage of this. Yeah. Instead, it's like, no, we're doing clever stuff.
Right,
in the back
and you can pace it. You can start modularizing as you go and bring in more as you want. And you can go all the way through to a full instant app if you wish. So that's a really cool thing that we invested in.
I liked some of the subtle stuff. So every release, we've been adding more of these sort of subtle UI flares. So The window management and system UI folks have been sort of doing stuff around the edges. I'm thinking specifically like the app launch, you know, animation experience. Like, there's now we're big and mature enough that we can take the time to just start polishing the rough edges in more ways.
And the polish stuff really matters. Like, you know, a regular user, they may not be able to tell you why or what happened that they
it
just feels better. Yeah. And you know, we have high-speed cameras, and we can slow down the frame rates, and we know what it is, but you can't overemphasize the importance of, like...
It's also such an interesting thing that, you know, you can make your code as fast as possible, but sometimes, like, to make it feel faster, like, it's just a matter of, like, changing timings in animations or in the gestures. Like, nothing is actually going faster. It's just, it feels more natural. And
I was going to say, like, natural is the magic word, right? Like, that's really sort of the philosophy of material design, which is, like, can you design a UI that is sort of physically realistic, right? Like, if something moves, does it have the physics of a real physical object, you know, with the right sort of velocity curves, acceleration curves, and whatnot? And because we're hacking your visual cortex to think that these are physical objects underneath the glass that you're manipulating. And so, you know, there's definitely a way to make it feel natural to your animal brain, and conversely, to not make it feel natural.
Yeah, a feature I really miss that, you know, it wasn't natural to your animal brain, but... on the Nexus S, you turn the screen off, we had the CRT effect.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It was basically like,
cool.
You know, it was amazing. And I'm so sad that went away.
Yeah.
So, like, if you can get the system
like
UI team.
Nice 1950s flare.
Yeah,
it just felt so satisfying. I actually turned my phone off and on just for that effect.
You're totally dating yourself. But I love that feature. I remember, I can remember the code for it. it lives in Service Linger.
Who was that? Was that a Matthias?
It was I designed it in After Effects, and Matthias implemented it in Service Linger.
Yeah. It was really cool.
Bring it back.
But yeah, that subtle effect where we would shift the RGB plane so it had a little bit of color fringing.
Yeah. That was awesome. Yeah. It reminded me of like TVs when I was a kid. And it's awesome.
All right. And other softball question, which is, so you've been here, what, 2007, right? So
yes.
Going on a while now.
A dozen years, actually.
Apparently you like working with Android. What's your favorite thing about Android?
You know, I think it really is the ecosystem. I don't know of an ecosystem that's anything like this, both in terms of impact and complexity. You know, there's that definition of a platform being that, like, a true platform is when the combined market cap of the companies that are built on the platform are greater than the market cap of the company that creates the platform, right? And I think that's absolutely true with the Android ecosystem. And the ecosystem, like, well, what is it? Well, really, we are pairing developers with customers or users, and we're comparing device makers with developers and users, right? And so you have this really interesting sort of dynamic. And, you know, what gets me up in the morning is just the impact that we can make, both in terms of billions of users, but all of these other businesses, you know, silicon vendors, device makers, application service companies that who then employ like hundreds and thousands of people themselves. And it's just, you have that sort of multiply magnification effect.
I think a key part of the Android ecosystem is that, you know, we've built something that people took and still take to places that we had not anticipated or imagined. Early on, I remember, like, you know, the first cars or fridges, Or like we just got, you know, one of those indoor bikes, and there's a giant tablet on it, and it's running Android. And I was telling my wife, yeah, it's like, look, my code's running in your bike.
On airplanes, I always try swiping. Can I get the home
button? I do that too. I'm like, when did they suppress that gesture? I'll see. And sometimes they don't. You can find some really.
That's what I love about, you know, that ecosystem that even work, you know, I worked on the platform for 12 years as well. It's like, and I still discover new things about Android and products that I'd never heard of. Like,
and you look at some of the new emerging categories like TV, and Android TV is really on a huge like hockey stick. And you ask, why is that? And again, it's really because of the ecosystem. It's the fact that there's a developer platform. Like if you strip Android down, it's like connecting developers to users is actually the core nugget. And it's really hard to do and hard to do well. And I think that's my favorite thing about Android, and it's most valuable thing, I would say.
Yeah, way easier to drive it as a world than as a single company sort of pushing its agenda down people's throats. Right?
Yeah. And then if you like complexity, you know, like coming into work every day, like the multidimensional optimizational problem that you have to solve when you've got device makers, silicon vendors, users, developers, and carriers, you know, it's a very intellectually challenging and kind of enjoyable problem. I think one thing you got to do, and I always make sure I do this, is at the end of the day, the most important thing, you know, without a doubt, is do the right thing, the best thing for the user. That's all that matters. And everything else follows. And that's one of the sort of North Stars that I try to abide by in this world of complexity that we have in our ecosystem.
All right. I'm all out of questions. Anybody else?
No, just one real quick that I wanted to ask at the beginning. So, you know, given your job, like I'm sure like the context switches you have to make during the day are multiple and go all over the place. How do you deal with that? Because I have that some days where like, you know, during the same day, I will be doing like, you know, color management and then 3D rendering and then something in UI toolkit and then something about Kotlin. And like at the end of the day, it's really exhausting. Like,
I think I have a capacity for N context switches a day, and I'm okay up to that point N. And if you give me N plus one, then my brain just melts. And
oh, you shouldn't have told us that.
Okay. No, I didn't tell you what
already.
I didn't tell you what N was.
I'll figure it out.
All right. So just tell people no.
Go away.
All right. Cool. Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.